With that in view, I'd like to introduce our first keynote speaker. Now, I could do this sort of conventional thing and say, of course, Bill Trosham needs no introduction, but I won't. We've worked out he did provide a very full statement for me to introduce him. Well, no, for the conference to introduce him, but suggests that perhaps you might like to read the full lot in the Book of Abstracts. And I'll just talk about a couple of things that you might want to know. He's the immediate past president of the Australasian Evaluation Association.
American Evaluation.
Oh, what a shame. AEA rather than AES. See, this is what I mean. He could probably introduce himself much better. He's currently the Professor of Policy Analysis and Management, and he's spent, now you'll realise, of course, he obviously entered university as an absolute child because he's been there for 29 years at Cornell. And his most, then the time he's been there, he's taught research methods and evaluation. Some of you will know him through his website, and some of you will know him through what he's written. And there are some of you who will know him because of the particular aspects that he's made developments in that are following in the same schools of thought that you're interested in. So I would like, after that rather inept introduction, I'm sorry, I'd like you to welcome him.
Thank you very much. Allow me a moment to get myself situated here. I'm going to put a timer on myself so that I don't go too long, and I'm going to get a glass of water. Well, first of all, thank you. Welcome to this conference. Thank you, Jenny, for your introduction and for your kindness in welcoming me here. Thank you, Mrs. Agnese, for your welcome to country. I truly do feel welcome by that and by the wonderful song that was provided. It reminds us of the importance of place and the importance of culture. And it's especially consoling to somebody who's traveled halfway around the world. This is my first trip to your country, to Australia, and I'm already learning an enormous amount about Australia. I'm learning that you do not fly into Sydney on a Sunday morning when virtually every jumbo jet that's going across the ocean arrives at the same time and think that you can make a connection in an hour to Canberra. It just does not work. I'm learning that at 4:30 in the morning, I am regularly being awakened by the melodious screeching of some kind of bird. I'll try to do it. It's sort of like very loud. We don't have that bird in the United States, and so I'm feeling privileged that I've now experienced a really Australian bird. And the third thing that I learned because my entire workshop class yesterday corrected me simultaneously and pointed out that those things that we have, those things that we eat during tea break, are actually called biscuits and not cookies. So I'm feeling already like I'm acclimating to Australia and becoming familiar with the culture and so on. I have to apologize. I have to give you my warning label in advance of all of this. Every time I do something like this, I vow that I'm going to follow the best advice for how to put together one of these speeches. You know, Tufte stuff about graphics, no PowerPoint slides with more than three words on them, and all that nonsense. And I have once again failed in that. I never seem to be able to do that. I just cannot let go of this academic penchant for words. And so I'm going to try to make this as delightful as I possibly can. But along the way, I'm afraid I'm going to violate a lot of those typical strictures, and I apologize in advance. The other thing I want to apologize for in advance is that it's very hard for me to try to anticipate this kind of an opening address for this kind of a topic. This is an extremely complex topic. It has all sorts of levels, and I expect that there are people who are coming at this from many, many different points of view and backgrounds. And so I've tried to anticipate that, but I'm afraid that for many of you, you already know a lot of what I'm going to talk about. I've tried to put in some things that maybe you don't, but I apologize in advance to those of you who are already very familiar with this topic. I can tell by looking at the program that there are many of you. But I did feel it was important for us to go through some of the basics of this whole issue of evidence. And I took it on myself. I thought it was very nice of you to invite me to start this off, but I felt a certain responsibility and interest in trying to lay out some of the questions associated with evidence and evaluation. I do believe this is one of the most important topics of our era in evaluation, and I'm going to try to convince you about why that's the case. So let me get right down to it. I'm going to just jump right in. I have lots of questions. I'm going to try to provide some initial thoughts about these questions. You folks are going to spend the next several days answering them far better than probably I can, and hopefully I can at least start the discussion rolling. So some questions, lots of questions about evidence. Where did this evidence movement come from? What has motivated it? Why is there so much emphasis on this topic of evidence today? What's the relationship between some of the terms we hear associated with evidence? Evidence-based practice, practice-driven evidence, the relationship of research and practice, or the integration of research and practice. What is that stuff all about? What constitutes evidence? How do we know it when we see it? What's the unit of evidence? When we talk about evidence, what is the thing we are talking about? How is evidence stored? How is it retrieved? How is it disseminated? You see, I got a lot of questions. How do we determine the quality of evidence? And for evaluators, it really starts to get very interesting when we ask ourselves, what is the role that methodology plays in determining quality of evidence? Because as Jenny has pointed out, this has become a source of great controversy. How does the move to evidence influence us as evaluators? How does it change what we think about evaluation and how we think about evaluation? And what role can we as evaluators play in generating, in creating evidence, in influencing this movement? Because I think there are many roles that we can play, and many of us have already started to play those roles. And ultimately, what role should evidence play in influencing evaluation? To what extent should we be moving to an evidence-based evaluation? So these are some of the questions that I'm going to touch on. Obviously, any one of these questions could probably occupy us for the better part of an hour, and so I'm going to really run through these things and try to give you a survey, an introduction to these topics, and I hope that they're topics and trust that they're topics that we'll talk about as we go through. So where did this movement come from? I think Jenny already alluded to health. I'm going to start off by showing you the cover of a little book that was put out in the year 2000 by Sackett and others called Evidence-Based Medicine. This wasn't the original story on evidence and evidence-based this and that, but it was one of the first. It certainly, I think, is the case that this evidence movement really originated in, got its emphasis in biomedical and health research, and originally under the form of evidence-based medicine. Sackett and others played a leading role in this, and some of the things that they described for why this was important, the need for clinicians to have immediate information, they were very much oriented from the point of view of the practitioner. They certainly pointed out how existing sources of evidence are inadequate. Textbooks are out of date. Experts are frequently wrong. Medical education is fallible and imperfect. And especially, the literature, the research literature, is just overwhelming. I think I read somewhere that at any given moment there's over 10,000 clinical trials going on around the world. And the volume of published literature is beyond anything that any reasonable human or clinician could keep up with. The decline in knowledge as clinicians get further and further away from medical school. And the need to have information at the time when a practitioner needs it. And so these are the kinds of motivating factors for the evidence-based movement. And where did it go from there? Well, one of the starting points, I think one of the key starting points, was in a group that's known as the Cochrane Collaboration. Again, I apologize. Probably most of you know what the Cochrane Collaboration is. This is a worldwide network of people who attempt to synthesize the research that exists in medicine around particular topics. What they, in effect, do is they use a statistical methodology called meta-analysis. They identify sets of studies that are investigating the same kind of treatment. They extract from those studies the statistical estimates of the effects of those treatment, and they do a synthetic analysis and report that synthesis. Now, the inherent notion here is that any given study, even a well-done randomized clinical trial, is fallible, is limited, and that the best we can do is to look across multiple fallible, imperfect studies and look at that synthetic estimate as a better guess about whether or not a treatment or program is effective. So in effect, the whole is more than the sum of the parts. And the Cochrane Collaboration began to go through the published medical and unpublished medical literature and do these meta-analyses. They've done hundreds, thousands of them at this point, and published these in Cochrane reports. So now the evidence that was available, instead of being individual studies spread out in a disparate literature, was in effect being gathered into these synthetic studies, these meta-analyses, and I think that many thought at that point that this is what practitioners should look at, and this is what should guide their practice. If you have a particular illness that you're treating, you should go to a Cochrane report. It'll synthesize the research for you. It'll tell you what works, and you should then apply that. Well, that was the initial impulse has started happening in the late 80s, I believe, in the early 90s, certainly. And the Cochrane is considered the granddaddy of all of the research synthesis efforts that's going on. It's going to come up repeatedly in this talk. It quickly migrated from medicine, this notion of evidence-based medicine, to public health. It's not surprising because public health and medicine are very closely aligned. And we began to talk about evidence-based public health, as exemplified here in a group, an initiative that's called the Community Guide. The Community Guide really trying to do something very similar to the Cochrane, in that it's trying to synthesize, sometimes, very often with meta-analysis, it's trying to synthesize across what do we know in public health, treatment for alcoholism, for drug abuse, for tobacco, and so on. So the movement went to public health. A number of agencies in the U.S., and I do have a U.S.-centric perspective on this. I apologize for not having a broader, more international view, but I'll talk to the U.S. perspective that I come from. The Agency for Health Care Research and Quality, groups like the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association, jumped into this game as well, began doing systematic reviews of the literature. All of these things trying to deal with the breadth of information that was absolutely unable to be grasped by any individual human being, and synthesize it in the form of some form of systematic review. I'm going to come back and talk more about meta-analysis and systematic reviews. Later on, a group that's called the Campbell Collaboration, named after my mentor and dear friend Donald Campbell, really began to model itself directly on the Cochrane Collaboration. In fact, the name even suggests that it was modeling itself on the Cochrane Collaboration, and attempted to do for social programs what the Cochrane Collaboration was doing for medical interventions. That is, they wanted to do meta-analyses and to publish reports about what worked in social program interventions. And they became a major player in that context. Well, these meta-analyses and research syntheses are still rather technical documents, and practitioners, I think, reasonably had some difficulty connecting them to practice. And along with the rise of those kinds of mechanisms, there also arose a mechanism that we would refer to as a guideline. Guidelines are developed by professional associations, by groups of experts, by a variety of entities, and they're really written as prescriptions to practitioners. Again, a lot of these guidelines are in the area of medicine and health, but increasingly moving into other areas. So guidelines might utilize meta-analyses, they might utilize systematic reviews, they might utilize expert judgment. They tend to be somewhat systematic. There's no consistent way that they're done, but increasingly we've got hundreds and thousands of guidelines that are available, sometimes multiple and conflicting guidelines, even in the same area. Places like the National Guideline Clearinghouse or guidelines.gov are trying to accumulate these guidelines and put them in a repository so that they are accessible. Well, this movement moved to education. Partly the Campbell Collaboration and their crowd was involved with that. I would cite there as an example of the evidence-based education movement in the United States, the What Works Clearinghouse, which again is trying to be a repository of evidence about what works in education. And most recently, in the United States, we've begun to see a lot of emphasis on what they're calling comparative effectiveness reviews. The Obama administration actually committed $1 billion of stimulus money to the development of and conduct of comparative effectiveness reviews. Now, these are particular types of reviews that look at head-to-head competitions, if you will, studies that compare directly in an empirical way different real-world treatments and attempt to assess comparatively which ones work under what circumstances. This is a very new developing area. There's a lot of interest in the United States, a fair amount of money behind it, and I see this as sort of the latest type of evidence movement that's going on, at least in the U.S. So where this movement came from was through medicine into public health, into applied social programs, into education, through groups like Cochrane and Campbell and the Guidelines Clearinghouse and so on. Why is there so much emphasis on this today? Well, I'm going to cite a document that I'm going to cite over and over again, and I highly recommend that you get. This is a report that was put out by the Institute of Medicine, one of the highest quality sources of information in the United States about medicine and medical research. And it was put out last year. I think it's a great summary of the kinds of things that I'm going to be talking about and a very well-balanced description of how I think some of the smartest people in the field of medicine are thinking about evidence. But they made an unequivocal statement. Before the move toward evidence-based practice, medical textbooks and articles were filled with thousands of statements and care recommendations that were based solely on the belief of the author or at best a consensus of experts. And that's just not good enough. This is the document that I refer you to. You can actually download this off the Institute of Medicine site. It's called Knowing What Works in Healthcare. It's available as a PDF. I really recommend looking into it. They made claims like the following. There's an overwhelming evidence base. There's evidence that evidence is not being used in practice well. There's tensions between the domains of research and practice. There's tremendous pressure for practitioners to be accountable. You practitioners, how do you know what you're doing is the right thing to do? There's legal pressures, there's policy pressures, there's pressures from funders, and there's a need to control quality of treatment. A lot of evidence that treatments in medicine in particular are extremely variable and that people die or get sick as a result of that. So there's a lot of impetus for this kind of emphasis on measurement. I want to move from that topic of where did it come from and why is there so much emphasis on it to talking a little bit about some of the terminology. I think when people originally got into the idea of evidence-based practice, evidence-based medicine, it really largely, I think, emanated from the researcher's perspective. And I think that if I could mischaracterize or overstate the argument, I think basically researchers were thinking to themselves, well, if only those practitioners would do what we know is the right thing to do. If they just follow what the research evidence shows, everything would be fine. And I think that they saw this as moving from evidence, from research, to practice. It didn't take long in medicine for the practitioners to push back on that and remind the researchers that, in fact, the problems that we're dealing with originate with practice. That research very often doesn't fit the exigencies and the idiosyncrasies of the practice context, that it wasn't a good fit, and that, in fact, a lot of times what researchers might have been researching might not have been the kinds of things that practitioners need them to be looking at. So I think there was a tendency to say, no, look, what we really need is practice-driven evidence, not just evidence-based practice. And I think you saw that dynamic begin to play out early on in this movement. I think there's a broad consensus among the people, certainly in medicine, biomedicine, health, and so on, that in fact now that neither of those one-way streets makes a lot of sense. That in fact what we really ought to be talking about is research practice integration, evidence and practice integration. This is a dynamic relationship, and I would point out that one of the major initiatives in the United States that the National Institutes of Health has been funding is called the Clinical and Translational Research Awards, the Clinical and Translational Science Awards, CTSAs. I'm actually an evaluator for one of the now 46 funded centers around the United States that are working on clinical and translational science. And one of the central purposes of that effort is a much, much closer integration of research and practice. How do we work across disciplines? How do we work across that gap between what researchers do and what practitioners do? So there's a growing awareness that this is a dynamic, that it's not going to be solved or addressed well by one-way directionality in distribution of what we know, and that this is a dynamic. So what constitutes evidence, and how do we know it when we see it? Now, I'm going to actually just state outright what I think the answer to this question is. I think that evidence is synthesized empirical knowledge that can be understood and used by practitioners. And I want to emphasize both of those, well, all three of those terms, synthesized, empirical, and knowledge. I think that, for me, sums up what I think evidence is. Now, when I think of evidence, sometimes I think about lawyers in a court. Right? A lawyer presents a case, and they do present bits of evidence. They present the gun, they present the fingerprints, they present a witness or two, they present the telephone logs, and so on. And each of those constitutes bits of evidence. They can each be considered evidence. But really, in terms of practice, in terms of what a jury has to do, the jury has to synthesize that stuff. They have to pull all that stuff together. And so the real evidence base for the decision that the jury is going to make is a synthetic one. And it's very seldom. And sometimes you're going to have DNA evidence or something like that that is in and of itself both a bit of evidence and a definitive on its own. But more often than not, that's not going to be the case, and I don't think that's the case in science either. And so I'm going to argue that evidence, as we understand it today, is really synthetic. It's also empirical. Empirical in a broad sense, and by empirical I mean the full gamut of how we come to know the world around us, qualitatively and quantitatively. And it is, in that sense, synthesized empirical knowledge. Well, when we think about what constitutes evidence, one of the first things that we realize is that evidence, whether it's in a courtroom or whether it's in research, differs in quality. And most of the evidence-based systems attempt to develop some kind of what they would call an evidence hierarchy to try to help practitioners judge whether evidence is of high quality, of moderate quality, or so on. Furthermore, even though something could be of high quality or low quality or variable quality, it may or may not suggest what a practitioner should do. And so most of the systems that exist for dealing with evidence also try to make recommendations in terms of the strength of the implications of the evidence for practice. So those two things, the hierarchy of the quality of evidence and its implication for practice, are typically done in most of these systems that try to look at evidence. Well, I'm really talking here about something different that's happened in the past 25 years or so. And so I want to perseverate on this for just a moment and make sure that I'm making my point well. The old-fashioned model of research went something like this. First of all, it was a pretty linear model. You do basic science. At some point, you develop the kernel of something that might be applicable or applied. You begin in medicine. You begin to do clinical research on that. You go through a whole series of trials and tests, determining the safety, the efficacy, the effectiveness of whatever it is. And at some point, you get to a point where you say, we have enough evidence. We disseminate that evidence. It gets used in practice, and it has a great impact on health. That's kind of the old model. I think what's happened since this evidence-based movement has arisen is that we realize we've got lots of basic research leading to lots of clinical research, and that something new has interposed itself here. It is this synthetic step. It is the step of trying to look in a systematic, empirical way across lots of evidence, bits of evidence, and trying to come up with a better estimate of what's happening than you would have by looking at any of the individual studies. And then we disseminate, use, and hopefully have an impact with that. But we also have the ongoing feedback loop from those who are involved in dissemination, from those who are involved in use, from those who are involved in policy, that it should and does inform basic research, clinical research, and the like. So I think one of the things that really strikes me about this from a systems point of view is that what we have interposed here is a jump in scale. If individual studies are local and synthetic knowledge is global to that, then what we are really talking about here is that this human system we are all participating in has, in the last 25 years, interposed something very new and very important, and it is this synthesis. And the evidence-based movement that we're talking about is inherently wrapped up in this jump in scale that goes from individual studies to synthesized knowledge. All right, so what's the unit of evidence? How is it stored? How is it retrieved and disseminated? Well, units of evidence, I'll talk about four of them. I've already introduced them. Certainly, meta-analyses are a type of evidence. And I think in the evidence-based movement, they are central types of evidence. These are quantitative syntheses across multiple studies. In some of the groups that do these studies, do these meta-analyses, they very strictly limit the types of studies which are allowable. Cochrane is notorious, for instance, in emphasizing inclusion of randomized clinical trials and downplaying other alternatives like quasi-experimental designs, controlled case studies, and the like. Although that's changing. So meta-analyses are one unit of evidence. Notice that it is true that an individual study, an individual evaluation can be a unit of evidence, but increasingly under this movement, we're moving away from that. We have seen something change. That's the big shift that's occurred. Another unit of evidence is a systematic review. Now, all meta-analyses are systematic reviews. They are a subset of systematic reviews. But not all systematic reviews are meta-analyses. Sometimes systematic reviews are systematic syntheses of experts' assessments of literature rather than simply statistical meta-analyses of existing studies. So while all meta-analyses are systematic reviews, there are systematic reviews which go beyond meta-analyses. Guidelines are units of evidence, and they are typically packaged up in a way that practitioners might find more useful and amenable, but they are also some of the stuff that we would constitute, we would say constitutes evidence. And then there's this new thing, comparative effectiveness reviews, and it's too early to tell exactly what that is. I think on the original group, the original site in the U.S. that's trying to promulgate this stuff, they have, I think, six or seven comparative effectiveness reviews now, as opposed to the thousands that Cochrane has and so on. So it's very new, but I suspect that those will also be units of evidence. So when I talk about units of evidence in an evidence-based context, this is the kind of stuff I'm talking about. And yes, well-done studies that stand alone can also be considered evidence, but increasingly what's changed is, what's happening is, we're moving to these kinds of synthetic forms of evidence. And where are they stored? Well, not surprisingly, in the kinds of places that I've already described to you. Cochrane Collaboration Community Guide, Campbell Collaboration, Guideline Clearinghouse, What Works Clearinghouse, and on and on and on. In fact, so much so that we're increasingly getting to a situation where we've got to start looking at the differences among these various groups and organizations and how the evidence that they're storing and promulgating differs. And I think that's going to be certainly a major part of what happens going forward. Well, at the heart of the evidence-based movement is the quality of the evidence. And how do we determine the quality of the evidence? I'm going to go back to this wonderful document, Knowing What Works in Healthcare. They point out that there are numerous hierarchies and typologies that have proliferated. They all have these weird codes and symbols, and the end result is greater confusion rather than clarification. So it's a bit of a mess out there in terms of judging the hierarchy of the quality of evidence. The people in at the heart of this movement in medicine are saying we really don't have consistent hierarchical standards. And this is a long quote, so I'm gonna just try to focus on the stuff that I think is really important here. They point out that evidence hierarchies in these various systems really have helped raise people's awareness to the idea that some designs, some approaches, some research methods have certain kinds of biases. But typically, these hierarchies consider just what type of research method was used, not how well it was done. So that randomized clinical trials, or RCTs, for instance, or prospective observational studies, are judged to be of a certain quality in a particular hierarchy, not because it was a particularly well-done RCT or prospective observational study, but because it is what it is. And they conclude by saying, findings from a poorly conducted trial should not necessarily trump evidence from a non-randomized study. I think that's a really profound statement coming from the establishment of the medical world in the United States. I think that's a pretty powerful statement and a pretty powerful critique of these kinds of hierarchies. Well, what do these hierarchies look like? I don't know if you can see this, but you'll get the idea. This is from a paper by Schunemann et al. And they basically just list a whole bunch of symbol systems that various groups and organizations use to represent the hierarchy of quality of evidence. Actually, there's two parts to this graph. The top here has to do with quality of evidence, and the bottom has to do with the implications of that evidence for practice. So in terms of quality of evidence, you know, some systems just use words. This is high quality evidence, moderate, low, very low. Some rank them in terms of numbers. This is a level one, this is a level two. Some use letters. This is an A, B, C, D. Some use these little circles. There's stars, there's all sorts of symbols. And basically, they're grading the evidence as a way of trying to communicate to practitioners what constitutes the better stuff from the stuff that's not quite as good. Now, in terms of the action or implications, again, they use a variety of systems. Some use words, you do this, probably do this, probably don't do this, don't do it at all. Some use numbers, letters, little traffic light symbols, thumbs up, thumbs down, and so on. This is part of the mess that constitutes the assessment of quality in these areas, and I think you can expect that this debate about both quality and its implications for use is going to continue over the next couple of years, and it really is at the heart of this evidence-based movement, and we evaluators have some important things to add to that. So what role do methods play in determining quality of evidence? Well, I'm going to argue that there's a dimension of views about quality of evidence and try to characterize them for you. Actually, Jenny sort of presaged this in her opening remarks. On the one hand, on one extreme, on the right-hand side of this model, we have a group of people, a group of groups who would argue that experiments, randomized experimental designs, RCTs, randomized controlled trials, are a gold standard. Generically speaking, they are a gold standard of evidence. They are at the pinnacle of the evidence hierarchies. And very often, they'll do that without much qualification. Right? On the other extreme, I think we have people in groups who are arguing for what I'm trying to describe here as a methodological pluralist pragmatism. That is, these are people who believe that there are lots of different methods. They're pluralists. That those methods that different methods may have strengths in certain circumstances, and that part of our job in determining quality of evidence is to figure out under what circumstances different methods are providing better evidence than others. In terms of who's on which end of this continuum, I would sort of roughly characterize it this way. My association, the American Evaluation Association, clearly in the camp of methodological pluralist pragmatists. And I'm not going to be coy with you here. I'm clearly in that camp, and I'm an advocate of it. And I do believe that in the end, that's where things are going to evolve. I'm confident that that's going to be the case. The American Educational Research Association, I think, is there. The public health people get it because they have to deal with a broader range of methodologies for the kinds of problems they have. People who do guidelines and deal with practitioners get it. They synthesize all sorts of evidence and deal with the fact that some evidence done in certain ways can be high quality, and the same kind of way of getting that evidence in another context may not be as much. And then, of course, the Institute of Medicine, one of the most definitive bodies in the United States, through the report that I've been citing and other reports, I think increasingly recognizes a pluralist pragmatic view. I'm going to come back to that. Who's on the gold standard side? Well, I would list here a group that I'm going to come back to and tell you a little bit more about as we go along, called the Coalition for Evidence-Based Practice in the United States. Very interesting group. I would include in there one of the central organizations in the U.S. federal government. This is a branch of the Office of the President. It's called the Office of Management and Budget, and they have responsibility for the management and budget of every U.S. federal program. And as such, they set standards for evaluation of programs, for what constitutes high-quality evaluation, and they have been arguing very much the experiment as gold standard argument. So has the U.S. Department of Education. And I'll come back to that. I'm going to revisit this controversy in a little bit of time. And so has the Campbell Collaboration, which I find particularly ironic because I'm a student of Donald Campbell's, and he was a proponent of randomized experimental designs, but not exclusively. He was also the inventor of the idea of quasi-experimental design. He was also a big advocate of qualitative research, of N-of-1 case studies, and of how we could use those kinds of sources of evidence, and how sometimes, when we're trying to reach valid causal assessments, those are going to be the best ways to do it. So I find it kind of curious that that the descendants of that school, that Campbellian school, many of whom are my dear friends and mentors, have taken a part of Campbell's work and have represented it as the central part of his work, that is this advocacy of the experiment as a gold standard. Now, in all of these contexts, there's vociferous debate. I know in the Campbell Collaboration, there's debate going on about how do we deal with evidence hierarchy, so I don't want to misrepresent this. They're not uniformly of that view, but overall, I think the Campbell Collaboration has been identified like the Cochrane Collaboration. Well, no, actually, Cochrane I'm going to come back to, like some of these other entities as being gold standard types. I actually moved Cochrane to the middle. I had him over on the right, but I've been catching a lot lately that in the Cochrane Collaboration, there has opened up a much broader debate about evidence hierarchies. And I really think that they are, like the Institute of Medicine, actually rethinking the role of alternatives to randomized experimental designs in evidence. So I want to spend a little time going through these debates. I actually think this debate about the randomized experiments as the gold standard is the most important controversy in evaluation in this era. Right? I really think that this is, to this era, what the qualitative-quantitative debates of the late 80s and early 90s were to that era. This is an extremely divisive, extremely controversial area. It's one where friends become contentious, and it's one that I would like to see us work through and get past because I think it's wasting a lot of energy. So anyway, I want to characterize the gold standard first to show you what I'm talking about there. Here's a statement from the U.S. Department of Education, 2003. Well-designed and implemented randomized controlled trials are considered the gold standard for evaluating an intervention's effectiveness in fields such as medicine, which I highlighted here, welfare and employment policy, and psychology. All right. So this is an unequivocal, unqualified statement. It's not saying for what programs, at what time in the evolution of a program, in what context is randomized trial a gold standard. It's making a pretty sweeping statement about randomized experiments being a gold standard. This is a gauntlet. This is a very provocative way of stating this. They could have chosen any number of ways of stating the role of randomized experiments in evidence. They chose this particular way. They also cited first, and it's not surprising they cited first, medicine, because the advocates of randomized controlled trials believe, I think, that and look to the field of medicine as the model of how evidence ought to be accumulated, and they see that randomized clinical trials are a central part of the model in medicine. They're a central part, they're not the only part, and I'm going to argue later that in fact the advocates of randomized experimental designs are only selecting a part of what makes so much sense in medicine and missing some absolutely critical elements that we need to add in. Well, so where did this come from? Well, this report that the U.S. Department of Education had was not written by the U.S. Department of Education. It was written under contract by this group I mentioned to you earlier, the Coalition for Evidence-Based Policy. So who are these guys? The Coalition for Evidence-Based Policy is a not-for-profit, independent lobbying organization that exists outside of Washington, D.C. It's basically run by a very smart lawyer who is a very effective lobbyist who talked to the U.S. Department of Education, who actually is connected with a lot of my pals in the Campbell Collaboration. If you look at the board of directors of the Coalition for Evidence-Based Policy and you look at the board of directors of the Campbell Collaboration, you're going to find a lot of overlap there. All right, so there's some connection there, right? And this particular group actually wrote the standards for the U.S. Department of Education that became extremely controversial. Well, let's go a little deeper into that very report. They say, how do you evaluate whether an educational intervention is supported by rigorous evidence and overview? This is from their user-friendly guide in 2003 for identifying and implementing educational practices supported by rigorous evidence. They say, step one, is the intervention backed by strong evidence of effectiveness? Well, how would you know that? Quality of studies needed to establish strong evidence, randomized controlled trials. That's about all they say there. Okay. And quantity of evidence, well, it should be done in multiple places and so on. And so randomized controlled trials equals strong evidence. Simple. Okay. Step two, if the intervention is not backed by strong evidence, is it backed by possible evidence of effectiveness? Well, what types of studies can comprise possible? Well, randomized controlled trials and comparison group studies in which the intervention and comparison group are, their quotes, very close, their italics, very closely matched in academic blah, 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 blah. All right. Types of studies that do not comprise possible evidence, pre-post studies, comparison group studies, in which the intervention and comparison groups are not closely matched. So we now are ruling out the entire endeavor of statistical modeling and corrections for selection bias. If you're an economist, you've got to be bristling, to say the least. Not to mention, we're ruling out all qualitative research here. It's not even showing up on the radar screen. Meta-analyses that include results of such lower quality analyses. Right. So step three, if the answers to both these questions are no, one may conclude that the intervention is not supported by meaningful evidence. Oh, notice how they slip that in there. Isn't that an interesting thing? You start off talking about strong evidence, and then if you don't have the strong evidence as defined by this, what you got isn't even meaningful. All right? I mean, think about that. That's a pretty interesting jump there. Well, so this was the Coalition for Evidence-Based Policy, Department of Education. Let's move over to the U.S. Office of Management and Budget. Now, they are responsible, as I said, for all U.S. federal programs. And they developed a system called, under the Bush administration, actually started under Clinton, called the Program Assessment Rating Tool. I'm, by the way, a big fan of the U.S. Office of Management and Budget doing this kind of stuff. And I'm trying to encourage them to do it in a way that makes sense and to improve what they've got. But I don't want to at all have you misconstrue that I'm opposed to the idea that they should be in this business. They should. So as part of this program assessment rating tool, the PART system, they came out with guidance. And it was a guidance document they gave to every single federal agency for what constituted a good PART review. I'm not going to read this whole quote to you, but notice where this really came from. This guidance was written under contract by the Coalition for Evidence-Based Policy. I think that's kind of interesting. These guys get around, right? And so what are some of the extracts from this? It's going to sound familiar. The guidance points to the randomized controlled trial as an example of the best type of evaluation to demonstrate actual program impact. No qualifications, no hedging, no appropriately saying, well, under certain circumstances, none of that stuff. They're just going right for it. And RCTs are considered the gold standard. So this is provocative. This is not careful. This is provocative in the way in which they did that, and doesn't, I don't even think, constitute good science. And it was it's part of this movement for the gold standard position on this. Well, now I want to talk a little bit about the alternative view, the other end of the spectrum. I'm going to go back to that Institute of Medicine report. This is a long quote from this, and I don't want you to listen to the words. What I want you to listen for here is the tone. How different that is than what I just read you. So here's the kind of things they're saying. RCTs can answer questions about efficacy of screening, preventive, and therapeutic interventions. Observational studies are generally the most appropriate for answering questions related to dot, dot, dot. Cohort studies and case series are useful for examining long-term outcomes because blah, blah, blah. Right? The best evidence on potential harms related to oral contraceptive use may be from non-randomized cohort studies or case control studies. This is a very different way of thinking about things, right? These folks are pluralists. These folks are looking at what seems to be the most effective methodology under different circumstances. Well, I'm very proud to say the American Evaluation Association has begun to enter into this discussion in a pretty serious way, and much more so in the last couple of years. We were late to the game, but we are definitely in the game now. This began with the Department of Education report that I cited a little while ago. It became very controversial at a conference that I fortunately was unable to attend. I think it was one of the only ones I was unable to attend, and because I was not there, I did not get swept up in all this controversy. I don't think I would have ever been elected president of AEA had I been there, because I would have been in the middle of it. But fortunately, I couldn't. I had had some surgery a couple weeks before, so I missed all the fun. But it was bad. It was a very nasty conference. The Education Department issued its regulations, very heavily influenced by the Coalition for Evidence-Based Policy, and the controversy was off and running, and they gave a month for public responses to their proposed regulations, and the month included the AEA conference. And so people at the conference said, we've got to respond to this now, and they began drafting statements. And in the process of that, all of this stuff erupted. Well, what did they come up with in their response to the Education Department's regulations? They said randomized controlled trials are not the only studies capable of generating understanding of causality. They're not anti-RCTs. They're just saying it's not the only thing, right? They're not always the best. They should sometimes be ruled out for reasons of ethics. Not an RCT person around that I know would disagree with that. They also say in some cases data sources are insufficient for RCTs. Pilot, experimental, exploratory education, health, and social programs are often small enough in scale to preclude the use of RCTs. This is really important. What they are suggesting is that at some points, and for some types of programs, at some point in those programs' developments, an RCT is not even an appropriate method to be using. We know that in medicine. When we do phase one clinical trials, we're not using RCTs. We're doing safety studies. We're trying it out in small cases, right? So this is precluding this notion that I'm going to talk about a little bit more later. Actual practice and published examples show that there's alternatives and mixed methods that are rigorous and scientific. I think that's not a bad statement on the part of AEA, although it was extremely controversial. We lost many people. Well, not that many, but we lost some key people in AEA because they felt that statement didn't represent their views. The American Education Research Association also responded to the Department of Education, as they should have. Notice what their response is. They're saying, we appreciate the value of experimental designs. We believe that a judgment of best does not adequately account for other methods of evaluation that might be as or more appropriate depending on the specific educational program. Not exactly an anti-RCT statement. It's basically saying there's a place for randomized designs. There's a place for lots of things. Another one, the American Evaluation Association later. This is one I'm very proud that I had a role in. I became the chair of a new group in the AEA called the Evaluation Policy Task Force. And our goal was to try to influence evaluation policy. And we began with the U.S. federal government. And the first place that I went to was to the Office of Management and Budget. And this was the end of the Bush administration, so I really didn't know what kind of reception I was going to get. And I have to say, I was quite surprised. I showed up at the office and explained to a very nice man, Mr. Robert Shea, why we were there and what we were concerned about. And he said to me, where have you people been? And he said, the only people we've been hearing from is this Coalition for Evidence-Based Policy. And he said, and we had them write our guidelines, and we distributed them to federal agencies, and now we're just getting a whole raft of criticism from federal agencies that are saying, this doesn't work, this isn't appropriate, we need alternatives, and so on, and we don't really know what to do. We need some help trying to sort this problem out. I thought it was really kind of an interesting and somewhat embarrassing issue, because AEA should have been there long before then. But we were there. And so what we did, he asked us, he gave us a week. He said, we'd like you to critique the guidelines document. And so we have some great people on this group. Let's see if I can remember who they are. Eleanor Chalimsky, Mel Mark, Leslie Cooksey, Patrick Grasso, Catherine Dawes, Stephanie Shipman, some really good evaluators in the U.S. on this group. And so we cranked for a week and came up with a response to this. And what do we see? Well, we said stuff that wasn't surprising to any of us, but was to them. RCTs are weak with respect to the goal of program improvement. They don't by themselves explicitly address construct validity. And that's deceptive. And construct validity has to do with, is your program what you think your program is? Is it implemented well? Is it implemented with fidelity, consistently, and so on? And are the outcomes measuring what you think they're measuring? You don't have those things, then an RCT is not going to help you a heck of a lot. You'll be doing an RCT on a program that's different than what you think it is, measuring things that are different than what you think they are. So without construct validity, you've got nothing. You've got to have that before you do an RCT. RCTs are weak with respect to generalizability or external validity. We've known that since the days of Cook and Campbell and before. That's always been a concern of RCTs. If you want to address RCT's validity problems, you have to do other things. You have to do things before you do an RCT. You have to do things in conjunction with RCTs. The importance of mixed methods, clearly, feasibility issues, equity, and ethics issues, and we pointed those things out. So it was a nice counterargument, and I was very proud of that. So I want to reformulate this debate a little bit. This struggle has certainly been difficult. It doesn't need to be this hard as far as I'm concerned. The danger right now is that we have, I think, an over-advocacy of RCTs as the basis of evidence. The problem is not whether to use them. The problem is when they should be used. Now, they shouldn't necessarily be used for everything, even eventually. But I think the real immediate problem we have is when should RCTs, if at all, be used in evaluating the effectiveness of programs. And I really think that the major problem that we're dealing with here is the problem of what I'll call premature experimentation. The danger that experimenting before its time might pose. I don't have time to go into this in great detail, but it does remind me of what Donald Campbell used to talk about when he used to say, we should only evaluate proud programs. And what he meant by that in those days, what he meant by evaluate was do causal assessment of effectiveness. And he was really saying, you don't do that on programs that are just starting out. You don't do that on programs that are evolving. You don't do that on programs that haven't got themselves systematized, that aren't being implemented consistently, for which we don't have good measures, and so on. You wait until those programs are ready, and then you do experimentation. And very much the position that I would take. Well, so I think we need to reframe this whole issue. And I think one of the problems is that the advocates of RCTs looked at the medical model and they said, the key ingredient in the medical model was randomized controlled trials. Let's do that in education. Let's do that in social programs and so on. I think they missed something. And I think they missed two things, without which the medical approach to evidence, which has its own problems, but without which it's not going to work. What they missed was the phased, multi-phased trial approach of clinical medicine. That is, when you start evaluating a new potential clinical treatment, you don't start with a randomized trial of effectiveness. You start with phase one trials of safety, of tolerance and the like. You do the phase two trials of efficacy. And only when you get to that point, when you've got some evidence of that, do you move to those more controlled trials. And the vast majority of medical interventions do not survive to that level. The FDA in the United States estimates that probably only about 30% of medical interventions that start through the phase clinical trial process survive to those phase three clinical effectiveness trials. That's really worth keeping in mind, because if we got people who are advocating the use of randomized controlled trials for all educational programs, as some are in the United States, and actually at one point in the regulations, the U.S. Department of Education suggested that they wanted to push to upwards of 70% of all educational evaluations being randomized trials. I mean, that's sort of backwards from this notion of a phased model that is in medicine. And the other thing is that in medicine, we need cultural anthropologists to go study how they did this, but they really have a cultural norm in that area that understands this sequencing, this building this winnowing out of new prospective treatments through phased trials that at some point may very well get to randomized trials. So if you just take the randomized methodology and say, all right, that's what's working so well in medicine, say we're going to do that in education, you're missing out on, I think, the key ingredients. Well, I'm going to argue that I'll match your scientifically rigorous randomized trial, which, by the way, I probably am conveying the impression that I don't like or advocate randomized trials. I actually do them. I'm engaged in lots of them at Weill Cornell Medical Center. I'm a big proponent of them. But so don't that's my caveat. But I'll match this notion that randomized trials are scientifically rigorous. They are. Under certain circumstances, and I'll raise you one, as I want to offer a more scientifically rigorous framework for us to talk about this that I think situates randomized experiments a little bit more sensibly. And what is the framework I'm going to offer? I'm going to offer the strongest framework I can find in contemporary science, and that is Charlie Darwin and the idea of evolution. So I think there's something important here. I think that it's built into this notion of phased clinical trials. It's built into what the AEA was talking about when they were saying, hey, small programs, when they're starting out, right, don't warrant randomized experimental designs. I want to argue that we evaluators, we methodologists, need to embrace the theory of evolution with respect to what we're doing in evaluation. I only have a few moments to explain this, so I'm going to try and go through it quickly. What are some of the key concepts of evolution I want to use in this way? Well, first of all, the idea of phylogeny in evolution. That's the idea of descent by modification, the tree, the evolutionary tree. You've all seen the tree with different species as time goes on. Well, I want to argue, as by the way Donald Campbell would have argued and Karl Popper would have argued, I want to argue for the idea that programs evolve, interventions evolve over time, just like anything else evolves over time. The same rules of evolution apply. And that is blind variation, selective attention of those programs that have a fitness to their environment. And we could talk for long periods of time about what that all means. And I want to be very careful to suggest to you that I'm not talking about the survival of the fittest. I'm talking about the survival of programs with fitness. I think that's the interpretation I want to use for that particular notion. So we need to think about our programs. You know, we evaluators do a program evaluation. We're thinking about that particular organism. The program evaluation is looking at this program at this time. But we are entering into and part of a much longer evolution, this longer time horizon. And there's a phylogeny involved there. And the evidence-based movement makes that very clear, doesn't it? Because now in that evidence-based movement, they're talking about this cumulative synthesized knowledge that happens over periods of time. It doesn't happen with one clinical trial. It happens over a long period of time. That's an important concept from evolution. Second important concept from evolution, ontogeny. It's sort of the companion of this. The idea that organisms, all organisms, go through phases in their existence. We as humans start out as infants, childhood, young adulthood, middle age, aging, and so on. And it's not invariable. I don't want to suggest that this is just a linear, invariable kind of progression, but there is some progression there. I mean, it is true we've got adolescents who stay in adolescence forever, and we've got some middle-aged people who revert to adolescence, and there's all sorts of counter moves there. But in general, this notion of ontogeny is a useful one. I want to argue that we need to think about the ontogeny of programs, of interventions. Programs are not the same when they start than they are when they mature. And in fact, we need different things at different stages of its evolution. Now, the third concept I want to introduce is the idea of symbiosis and coevolution, the bee and the flower. Both of them complement one another. They're not conscious of doing that. They have co-evolved to complement one another. The bee pollinates other flowers. The flowers provide the bee with honey and so on, and with nectar. And this has been a coevolution that has occurred. So instead, what I'd like to argue is that programs and the methods we use to evaluate those programs need to be symbiotic. That is, we need to be using the appropriate methodologies for the stage of development, the ontogeny, of the program that's involved. And if we look at it that way, I would argue that we can come up with a much more sensible idea of how methodology relates to the generation of evidence. So I'm going to argue for a phased approach to evidence. I'm going to have to move relatively quickly. The AEA in our comments to the OMB guidance laid out this very model. Not surprisingly, I had some hand in influencing this. Talked about the multi-phased trial approach. Talked about the idea that randomized designs are usually not used until late in phase two, or more likely phase three, that most programs don't survive to that, and so on. We need clear criteria. If we want to be rigorous about evidence, it's not just about using a rigorous design. We need rigorous criteria that help us to determine when a randomized experiment is warranted. And I want to talk a moment about that. What would that be? We need to make sure that we don't mount randomized experiments, and we'll have to debate these. I mean, these are my initial thoughts, until we have an articulated program model. We shouldn't be doing RCTs if we can't implement the program consistently and with high fidelity. We shouldn't do RCTs until we have high-quality outcome measures that are demonstrably high quality. We shouldn't do RCTs until we can demonstrate the program has the capability of generating change, efficacy studies. We shouldn't do RCTs if we don't have sufficient statistical power, and on and on and on. In other words, I think that we need to develop some rigorous criteria for determining when RCTs should be done. I think we also need to develop an evidence generation culture. And I do look to medicine as this. They've done a remarkable job of training people from nurses and nursing aides to physicians and clinicians about the general idea about how we take innovations and move it through a series of steps. When they get a new idea, they know exactly what's coming down the line. They can see it for the next 15 years. They know they're going to be doing phase one studies for this period of time, phase two studies here. It's just built into the fiber and fabric of how they think about things. We need that kind of impetus. I'm not going to have time to talk about what the implications is for practitioners, for institutions and organizations, for decision makers and funders, but suffice it to say that all of these stakeholders need to be brought into the shift in norms that this kind of view of evidence would include. So what do we do as evaluators? How do we play in this game? Well, I do think that intervention trials are a form of evaluation research. I know we call them clinical trials, but I see them as a form of evaluation research. I don't make a big distinction. They're not the only type of evaluation, but they are a form of evaluation research in my mind. So part of the way we play in the evidence movement is by doing evidence generation. We have a real challenge here in understanding this whole process of integrating research and practice. There are evaluation questions all through this that we can play in. Evaluators can play a key role in understanding how do we best disseminate, how do we best integrate research with what practitioners need. And I think we evaluators have a responsibility to add to this debate about methods. I think we come from a unique perspective as applied researchers, and we need to be heard. So what role should we play? We should practice what we preach. We should develop an evaluation evidence base. We should be doing that. I mean, when's the last time we did systematic trials on new evaluation approaches to see whether they were safe, whether they could be tolerated, whether they had efficacy, whether they might be effective, whether they compared well with other approaches? We don't do that. We need to be thinking about that. I'm actually trying to do that in a series of studies with NSF. I started with, I don't have time to go through this whole thing, but I have an idea for how we might package up systems thinking into evaluation so that any group or organization could do a good job of planning, implementing, and utilizing evaluation and incorporating systems thinking in it. So there's the kernel of my idea. I did a two-year, three-year phase one trial, very messy trial, trying it out. Getting some preliminary evidence. I then got funded by the National Science Foundation for a five-year phase two trial. I'm at the end of year one of that, where we're really trying to determine whether or not that approach is efficacious, whether or not it can bring about change, not bring about, whether it's associated with changes. And I fully expect that if this thing works well enough, if we're able to provide enough evidence, that I'm going to go back to NSF or somebody else in 4 years and say, all right, it's time for a controlled trial. And we should mount that nationally or internationally, and we should really do it well. We might even use an RCT to see whether or not that works well relative to other standard approaches for planning, implementing, and using evaluation. Well, so I'm trying to incorporate that model, and in a true evolutionary sense, this might not survive. It might not work, and I might not make it to a phase three trial. Notice also the timeline here. In medicine, they're used to this. They recognize you have a new drug, a new treatment. It's going to take 15 years of trials before you're able to really develop the evidence that you might want to have on that. But we don't have that norm in our field. We probably need to. And so it felt really odd to me when I first began thinking about it. I'm thinking about the year, 2018? I mean, my God, I'll be retired if I'm still alive. But no, we've got to start thinking about that long time horizon. This is the way in which we build that kind of culture for evaluation. And I think we've long needed a much more empirically driven, evidence-based sense of what we're doing in evaluation. So, conclusions, evaluation needs to understand the evidence movement. We need to actively shape it. We should embrace, I think, the key to the rigor argument is not randomized experimental designs. I think the key to the rigor argument is an evolutionary model. There's nothing in science more rigorous than the theory of evolution, and I think if we apply that model to what we're doing, that will enable us to situate randomized trials in an appropriate place in the ontogeny of programs, and it will remind us evaluators that we're engaged in a phylogeny endeavor here. We're engaged in a long-term endeavor. We're not just evaluating a program right here, right now for this. We also can contribute to the evidence, to the synthetic knowledge that occurs over time. Evaluation needs to develop its own evidence base and to model these values. So there are many other questions. You're going to ask some of these questions. How can an emphasis on evidence be misused? All sorts of dangers there. I think there are some people out there who have financial or political interests who will use the cover of evidence-based stuff in order to deny payment for funding of things that don't meet the high standard of evidence they set. So if you want to kill education in the United States, for instance, and there is a group of largely right-wing Republicans who do, then one way to kill education in the United States is to set a very high standard of what constitutes evidence and then say to have the federal government say, we're not going to fund anything that doesn't meet that. That's a really effective political strategy. I'm not saying that's going on, but I'm saying I worry about that. When have we gathered enough evidence? How do we determine the balance of what types of evidence we need? How do we allocate resources? How do we train the next generation of researchers, evaluators, decision makers, practitioners? How do we educate the public about evidence? Well, We could go on and on. We have a lot of work to do. I think you've been extremely patient to listen to me go on and on about this. I hope that I've raised some questions and maybe stimulated you, got your dander up a bit, depending on how you feel about these issues. But again, thank you for allowing me to introduce this conference, and let's go and start working on some of these problems. Thank you.